You are listening to episode 7 of the FitzPro podcast with me, Annie Miller. I am your host, and today on episode number 7, I am doing a Q&A from my Instagram following. So if you follow me on Instagram, I asked a few weeks ago what questions you would like me to answer on the podcast. I have not prepared my answers whatsoever for this, so this is me just answering these on the fly with whatever comes to my mind. So this could be good. This could be dangerous. We shall see. But if you are a person that commented and did leave a question, I am answering them all today. So without further ado, let's dive in. The FitzPro podcast is your no BS approach to seeking out truth in the world that is online health and fitness. You'll see through the lens of the trainer, the trainee, and the entrepreneur. I'm your host, Annie Miller, certified strength and conditioning specialist, entrepreneur, lover of sleep, lattes, and dinosaurs, aka not your average FitzPro. And my aim is to help you grow your mind, body, and business through knowledge and authenticity so that you too can become a FitzPro. All right, let the Instagram Q&A commence. First off, I do want to say I'm recording this in our Chiang Mai apartment, so we are very close to the airport. If you hear any planes or vehicles or honking, my apologies. I'm working with what I got. So we're going to start off with these. Like I said in the intro, I have not prepared answers to these. I am reading them on the fly. I am not going to say who they're from, but I will cover what the question is and obviously give you the answer extensively. So question number one is in regards to what are the challenges of traveling, jet lag, keeping a routine, eating healthy, and exercising. So when Nate and I planned this trip, the original plan was to stay in 12 different places for extended periods of time, so 1 to 2 months. We have not done that because we wanted to see a lot more than what that, you know, 1 to 2 months in one place would allow us to see. So it has been more challenging than I expected. One of the huge things is that we do not get nearly the protein that we're used to getting at home. I did not bring any supplements with me. Supplements are not nearly as popular in other areas of the world or accessible as they are in the States. So not getting enough protein is huge. I notice a difference. I feel a difference. But eating healthy is not really that hard because where other areas of the world lack protein, it is very easy to get fresh produce. There's veganism is really big in other areas of the world. So as far as eating healthy, that hasn't been that big of a challenge. I definitely have drank more than I would when I am at home. When we're at home, you know, I'm in a schedule, I'm in a routine. I can better keep track of how many drinks I've had in a week, how often I'm having a drink with dinner. Whereas we eat out almost every single meal. So for 9 months, I have almost eaten out 100% of the time. So it's really easy if we're just out at lunch and we got some tacos. I'm like, I want a beer. I would never drink a beer at lunchtime at home. That is not something that would happen. So definitely more alcohol consumption. I don't feel it in an unhealthy manner, but I have definitely noticed I'm a little softer in the midsection these days. And that is, you know, I'm going to guess that's from the diet. I know that it's from the diet. That's not a guess. As far as exercising goes, so that's kind of nutrition. Way less protein, but it's decently easy to eat healthy. There are healthy choices, places. And, you know, it just depends on where you are in the world as far as how expensive that's going to be. And then I've been drinking more. So exercising, we got a gym membership in our first location, Santiago, Chile. We got a gym membership in, or we didn't get a gym membership, but in Rio, we ran almost every day. The boardwalk, we stayed on Copacabana. There's a huge boardwalk for bikes and running with like outdoor jungle gyms along the way on the beach. So I did a lot of beach workouts in Rio. I worked out on the outdoor gyms and ran a lot. I didn't want to be inside a gym when we were in Rio. It was just amazing to be on the beach all the time. And then for 8 weeks in Europe, I barely exercised. We were basically on the go almost every day for that 6 to 8 week gallivanting throughout Europe, which was exhausting. Amazing. I don't regret it. I think that you should absolutely take a road trip through Europe if you can at some point in your life. I realize we're very blessed to be able to do that. But the exercise took a hit, and we started our whole European adventure extremely sick. So we had green goop coming out of every orifice from our freaking neck up. And so that put a damper on the workouts anyway. And so we were sick for about 2 weeks in the beginning of that. Then we had 4 weeks left, and we pretty much just traveled. We were active, obviously. We were walking all the time. We were going on hikes. We were riding bikes. So it wasn't that we were sitting around doing nothing for 4 weeks. But as far as exercise goes, there was no organized, planned lifting or exercising. And then when we got to Budapest, we got a gym membership in Budapest as well as Poland. So I had 2 months there. That was November and December, where I was able to actually lift again and exercise in an organized fashion, which there was some definite barriers that came with that. I don't know that I've taken like 8 weeks completely off of training ever. So that was definitely rough for me in the mental game. I should actually do a podcast about this, like looking in the mirror and expecting to see what you're used to seeing as far as my body and my muscles and my structure, and that not being what is actually reflected in the mirror. So if I could have worked out in a space that did not have mirrors during that time, it would have been very healthy for my mental state. But it did feel amazing to be back in a gym, to be back lifting weights, to actually feel my body work. I really enjoy that. I enjoy a challenge and feeling the challenge. So when we got to Budapest, it was amazing to have the gym membership. Again, while we were in Budapest, we went on a 10-day road trip where there was no working out. So back and forth between working out and not working out. When we got to Poland, we worked out probably like 2 days on, 1 day off, 2 days on, 1 day off. Again, at the end of Poland, we took a 7-day road trip where there was no exercise. There was lots of riding bikes and walking. So again, we were active, but as far as lifting, and I talk about lifting because that is the form of exercise that I do when I am at home in a very structured routine manner, that I have had very little of over the last 9 months. And that's a first for me, really, in my life. I mean, I've been lifting weights since my freshman year of high school in a routine manner. So yeah, I'll have to blog about that or podcast about that at some point. And then in Chiang Mai, we got a gym membership on the first day. And it is worth noting that we definitely, in Budapest, Poland, and Chiang Mai, we basically got there and the next morning we immediately went to the gym to get a membership. So we got it set up right away. We did the research ahead of time. That was actually a factor in choosing our Airbnbs for our 1 month stays. We chose Airbnbs. We basically, you know, find a few that we liked and then researched gyms. Look at their websites, contact them, see if you can pay for 1 month without, you know, a massive initiation fee or giving them your credit card or whatever, because things are different in all areas of the world. So then we would look at the Airbnbs and be like, okay, which one is closest to this gym? And we would get that Airbnb. So we did that in Chiang Mai. And in Chiang Mai, we have been on, I actually decided to track my workouts in Chiang Mai and gave myself a gold star in my planner for every day that we lifted. I'm not following a structured program. I haven't been following a structured program this entire time because that would honestly just disappoint me because I know how realistic it is to stick to a structured program. And if I am doing a structured program, I want to hit every single day when I'm supposed to hit it. That's my personality. So I would basically be setting myself up for disappointment and failure if I was to do that while we were traveling. I try to be realistic in that. So in Chiang Mai, it has been 2 days off, or 2 days on, 1 day off, 2 days on, 1 day off. So I basically do a upper body lift, lower body lift, rest 1 day, upper body lift, lower body lift, rest 1 day. And I'm trying to be consistent in that manner. So that's where we are. Jet lag is real. I have, so that covered exercise. Basically, it's been on and off. When we stay somewhere for a month, we get a gym membership and work out as much as we can. But we also listen to our bodies, and I have very realistic expectations of my workouts while we're traveling. So as far as traveling and jet lag go, you guys, jet lag is so real. And you know that I live for sleeping. Okay, that we have this in our current Airbnb above the bed. There's a massive poster that just says, all you need is sleep, in gorgeous, like, cursive, cute handwriting. And I'm like, how can I get that in my suitcase, in my backpack? Because I need to be taking that home with me, because that is my life motto. It's fine. All you need is sleep. Jet lag puts a kink in that. But we have found kind of our system that works for us, for me especially. Really, we only get jet lag when we do, like, our big flights, when we cover a lot of ground. I would say basically 5+ hour difference, time difference, is really when you start to feel the jet lag. Anything under that, 3 to 4 hours, is like, oh, it feels kind of weird as far as the time of day. But I'm a pretty, like, if it's dark, I get tired and I go to sleep. It doesn't matter where I've been or what time my body thinks it is. It's like, oh, it's dark, it's time to go to bed now, which is why I hate staying in places that get dark at like 3 p.m. because it's really hard for me to push past that. So we arrive somewhere, and then typically we stay awake all day until about 6:30 p.m., 6 or 6:30 p.m. that current time, and then I will just sleep until 9 or 10 the next morning so that I get 14-ish hours of sleep, and then I'm literally golden. Like, doesn't feel weird at all. I did that our very, very first flight. We ended up pulling an all-nighter, so there was no time difference between Santiago, Chile and Arequipa, Peru, but we chose a terrible flight. It was a red eye. We were exhausted. And I did it there. That was the first time I did it, and I felt amazing the next day. So then I did it when we went from Rio to Rome, and then from Europe to Southeast Asia, Thailand. And every time it has been amazing. So I highly suggest doing that. We also obviously try to pick a flight where we get into our location between like 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. So we're only having to stay awake in that location for like 6-ish hours. 4 to 8 hours basically is what we have to stay awake for. And then we can sleep the entire night for 14 to 15 hours. So jet lag is real, but I feel like I pretty much got a handle on how to deal with jet lag and my personal body and sleep preferences. So there is that. That was a really long answer to that question, but it had a lot going on. So that was challenges of traveling, jet lag, keeping a routine, eating healthy and exercising. In regards to keeping a routine, guys, I don't have one. My in-hand planner keeps me sane. So I basically just have like tasks that I have to get done as far as my business goes for my business. And I have that for a month, and then I have it for a week at a time. And I basically just pick those, you know, pick a top two per day and get those done. So there is not a routine like I would have at home, which is a challenge for me. I am a type A structure routine type of person, but I have found, you know, what works for me and what feels good as we're traveling. So the next question is my favorite go-to snacks. Ugh, you guys, my soul was like crushed last night when I haven't really had a craving yet when we're traveling that I haven't been able to like quench somehow. That's not true. I miss my Siggy's Icelandic Greek yogurt every morning. When I am at home, I have a bulletproof coffee and my Icelandic Siggy's Greek yogurt. And I have said since Santiago, our very first location, that that is what I miss. And that's about it. I just miss my morning with my bulletproof coffee and my yogurt. So that is one of my favorite go-to snacks when I'm home. I highly look forward to like drowning myself in that yogurt when we get back. But the other night we went to, we went to like a 7-Eleven or a little mini mart of some kind. And I just wanted beef jerky so bad, you guys. I was like, oh, I just need some peppered beef jerky in my life. My body was probably craving protein. And they don't have that. They do not really do the beef jerky in a lot of places. They do like salamis and cured meats, but not beef jerky. So beef jerky is one of my go-to snacks when I am home. Beef jerky, fresh fruit, fresh vegetables. I am a person that just loves like crunchy fruits and vegetables. So for me, like an apple or a carrot, or I even just eat raw cucumbers. Really just raw snacks. I'm not a huge nut person. I just don't really like nuts that much. So those aren't a big one for me. But when I am home, my favorites are beef jerky, yogurt, and just fresh fruits and vegetables. I have a few protein bars that I really like when I'm home. I honestly can't think of like the specific names of them right now. I get them at New Seasons where my husband used to work. But other than that, those are my favorite snacks. When we're traveling, I really just try to get like fresh fruit and vegetables if I can. I'm trying to think of snacks that we've had when we traveled. We really don't get that much. If we can find some sort of bar, we'll get a bar of some kind, like some fruit and veggie / protein bar if they have those anywhere. But really the only time we need snacks when we're traveling is like in the airport. So we don't snack a lot because when we are traveling, I don't want to go out a million times during the day. So we really, I wouldn't say that we intermittent fast, but not intentionally anyway. We typically have a decent sized breakfast and then we'll get like at 9 a.m. And then we end up getting dinner at around 5 p.m. And we might go to lunch during the day, but it'll be like a smoothie or something small. So not really big on the snacks when we're traveling. But when I'm home, those are my favorites. Next question, go-to resources for training or coaching, books or websites. So any like resources that I use in a coaching, so like weightlifting manner, or my favorite websites. You guys, I really use Instagram a lot. Like I follow a lot of doctors and educated humans on Instagram. And for me, no matter what, the point is that you apply it. So for me on Instagram, I love following coaches that, you know, share things that I'm like, yes, I can use that with my client like today. I can make that happen. So I will link these in the show notes. I don't want to screw up their IG handles or their names. So for sure, the Active Life RX, following them on Instagram. I'm also in the Active Life coaching program, the coaching membership program. So I have access to their Facebook group, to their doctors, to all of the coaches that are in there. So for me, that's where I really pull from now. You can pay a monthly fee to do that. I just paid annually because I knew that it was going to be valuable to me. So the Active Life and Dr. Sean Pastuch is where I pull a lot of my information from. I also love learning from Doc Jen Fit. And I will link, there's probably 5 or 6 Instagram doctors, either PTs or chiropractors that I really learn from. As far as books go, Starting Strength is a great book for new coaches. I don't agree with everything in this book, but it is a very, very, very good and valuable foundational resource for someone who is trying to grasp the big lifts, the squat, the bench, the deadlift, the overhead press, and things like that. It's written in a very practical, layman's term manner. So Starting Strength is a great book. And really, if you're into like Olympic lifts or anything like that, Catalyst Athletics has programming books that you can read. that obviously have examples of different methods and programming that you can use specific to Olympic lifting. That would be beneficial if you are in CrossFit as well. A CrossFit coach, I would definitely suggest reading that. Catalyst Athletics is a very, very, very credible source to learn from. I'm trying to think of anything else. Oh, as far as just like programming goes, I suggest reading. There's the Juggernaut method, the Wendler 531. These are all books that you can read that have programming in them. I think a huge, huge, I get a lot of questions from coaches about how to program because programming is kind of my expertise. It's something I'm good at. It's something that I enjoy. A huge portion of my knowledge around programming comes from reading these books and doing it myself. Getting the experience of going through the Wendler 531, going through the Juggernaut method. I really suggest if you are a coach that if you are learning something about training, I don't think you should have to be able to do everything that you ever program for a client. I am against that, actually. I think that you can be a great coach without actually being able to do everything you have your clients do. But you should have a very good understanding of something you ask your client to do. And I think that that can come with experience of doing that on some level. So those are my kind of go-tos. Before, I used to hang out on T Nation a lot. I don't so much love it anymore. You can also, the blog 8 Weeks Out is a great one. That's Joel Jameson. He does the Ultimate MMA Conditioning, that book. I would also read that as far as heart rate training goes if you're a coach. And I'll link that in the show notes. That is what my monthly coaching call in December and January was on for my Built by Annie and one-on-one clients, was basically how to the basics of heart rate training and then how to apply that to strength training. And those methods that I was discussing in those coaching calls were from Joel Jameson's Ultimate MMA Conditioning Guide. So, and his blog is 8 Weeks Out. So I also suggest checking that out. Next, rep ranges. What are the differences and what do they do and mean? So this is kind of broad, but you need to understand about rep ranges is that programming is so complex, and I don't want to oversimplify it. And a lot of times rep ranges do oversimplify it. Like, you know, 8x2 is for power, 6x4 is for strength. Like, while those things are true, you can also get strong while doing 8x2. You can get strong while using a 5x10 method. So we shouldn't put these rep ranges into boxes necessarily. I think that you need to have an understanding of the overall goal of the entire program, not just the rep ranges that we use for the main lift, which I think a lot of people look at. So in general, I guess, rep ranges are in three categories typically. Four categories, excuse me. So you have endurance, which is going to be really, really high reps, like 15 plus repetitions. And then you have hypertrophy, which is just muscle growth, for those of you that don't know. And that's going to be like an 8 to 12 rep range. And then strength is going to be like 4 to 8 reps. And power is going to be 1 to 3 reps. So you have power, strength, endurance, or power, strength, hypertrophy, and endurance. Those are your four categories. As far as those are the training stimulus that you're going to try to get from these rep ranges. Hope that that makes sense. So four categories, those are your training stimulus that you're trying to get through these rep ranges. So you basically go from the lower rep ranges being power and then strength increasing to hypertrophy, increasing even more to endurance. So that's what they do. That's what they mean. But you need to also understand that there is a spectrum there. So you can absolutely be doing a power type set and rep range. So maybe you're doing 6x2 for your main sets, which is going to be a power type of It could be power or strength, depending on what exercise you're doing. So if you're doing a Olympic lift of some kind, which would be like a clean, a jerk, snatch, something like that, that's going to be power. And then strength would be just doing squats, excuse me, deadlifts, bench, overhead press, whatever your main lift is going to be for 6x2. That would be a strength exercise. So depends on what exercise you're doing, what is the goal of the exercise. That's why I say this is a really complicated question to answer in a quick Q&A. But just know that there's four basic categories and that those were the rep ranges. So 1 to 3 for power, 4 to 8 for strength, 8 to 12 for hypertrophy, and then 15 plus for endurance. That's like a That could be a very, very long podcast going over programming that would need to be like segmented into different parts. So I'm going to leave that there for now. Next question, certifications, ACSM, NSAM, or NASM, NSCA, ACE. So basically, these are all personal training certifications of some kind versus having a degree in things like kinesiology, biomechanics, exercise and sports science, self-education, experience, internships. Where does all of that fall into when it comes to being a coach? What matters more? So basically, this person wants my overall view of certifications versus a formal education versus just self-education. And I have done an extensive blog post on this. I think it was over 2,000 words. So I hope that this does not take 2,000 words. to answer right now. Basically, the biggest thing for me with any type of, and again, this is just my opinion, so you can do whatever the heck you want as a trainer. I am not the gold standard. So I think that the benefits to having a degree in kinesiology, biomechanics, exercise and sports science, these anatomy and physiology based degrees, is the basis of your education and your knowledge that everything else is built off of. I think that a personal trainer who is someone is coming to you to consult you about their body and changing it in some way, shape, or form. It is my belief that you should have a pretty freaking good understanding of the human body on a biological and a cellular and a physiological level before you're telling someone else what to do with their body. And that is just my personal opinion. That's my philosophy. And that is why I value the formal education piece of all of this. As far as certifications go, obviously you have to study for some of these more than others. It could take 6 weeks, it could take 3 months to study for some of these. You could get some of them in a weekend course. So sure, if you want to say that time is more valuable, then some of these are going to be more valuable than others. The person that's coming to you for personal training has no idea what the hell the difference is between ACE or NSCA or NASM. Okay? So from the client's standpoint, they don't know. Most likely, I shouldn't speak in absolutes. They most likely have no idea what your certification means. All they know is that, great, they're certified. They can tell me what to do. So really, this is more of a you thing and what your beliefs and philosophies are than what your clientele is going to be thinking of you. Your client comes to you for results, and that's what they see, so that's why they come to you. I think that both are valuable. I think that especially if you're going to work with colleagues in the field, it can help. If you ever want to do anything education-based, it can help. I got my CSCS, which is Certified Strength and Conditioning Specialist, due to the fact that I wanted to work in college athletics. To get that degree or to get that certification, excuse me, to get your CSCS, you have to have a 4-year degree. Technically, you can have a 4-year degree in anything, but I wanted to get mine, obviously, in something that was going to apply to what I wanted to do. So I hold the CSCS as the gold standard. I don't think you need your CSCS to be a personal trainer. I don't think you need your CSCS to be a great personal trainer or coach. It is not a requirement. It is my personal opinion that it is the gold standard. I do not think any less of trainers who don't have it. I think that the most important part, whether you have a certification, a formal education, or just personal experience through internships and self-education, trial and error on yourself, trial and error on clients, all of these are valuable. I think the most important part of any source of knowledge is how you can apply it to your practice. I think that that is the most important piece of all of this. I don't think that any one is better than the other. I think they all serve a purpose. I think it's good to have some, you know, paper underneath your butt, some letters behind your name. I think that a formal education provides an amazing basis for education and knowledge and an overall umbrella understanding of the human body on a cellular level. And, you know, but that means nothing. If you don't know how to apply that to training, if you can't piece those two things together, then obviously that doesn't benefit you at all. Again, I just think the application is the biggest part, and that knowing your philosophy as a trainer is huge in all of this as well. So if you don't know your philosophy, if you don't know what you stand for, then obviously none of these are going to do much for you. Your education in via your certification or your formal education or your experience isn't going to do anything for you. So know your philosophy as a trainer, really define that. It's okay to change your mind along the way. But your core philosophy should pretty much stay the same. You know, your practices and experience are obviously going to shift some other things, but know your philosophy and make sure that you are using your knowledge to apply it to your training and to your practice. The next question, my view of CrossFit. What is my view of CrossFit? You know, I think I owe CrossFit an apology because I have talked a lot of smack in the past about CrossFit because I, in the past, felt that it was very dangerous because of the lack of education for the coaches, the lack of requirements for a coach, and the taking somebody off the streets who has little to no experience and having them probably not assessed in any way, shape, or form. And that we're talking years ago. I'll come around to say that I support CrossFit now more than I ever have. But in the past, I felt like it was dangerous. What I saw, what I was exposed to was not in a positive light. So I literally worked when I was interning in college at University of Portland as a strength coach. I was also interning at a physical therapy clinic that focused on rehabbing athletes from, basically they were cleared by physical therapy, but we all know that doesn't mean you're ready to return to play. So this physical therapy clinic was a performance-based clinic that bridged that gap between somebody being cleared by PT, so, you know, their joints can hit all the right angles. That does not mean that they're ready to jab and juke and return to play. So we bridged that gap in this physical therapy clinic. One of the clinicians one time said to me, well, hey, I mean, as long as CrossFit's in business, we know we're in business because people were getting injured. I saw torn pecs. I saw torn hamstrings. I saw so many knee issues, so many shoulder issues, so many low back issues, so many underdeveloped glutes, overdeveloped lumbar, spinal erectors. So they had these massive muscles on the outside of their spine, which is just their spinal erectors. And then they would have super underdeveloped glutes, overdeveloped hamstrings. It was just a shit show. And so anyway, that is all to say that my relationship and my view and my opinions, which they're just my opinions, by the way, so take it with a grain of salt, folks, have changed over the years. I think that coaches are getting better. I think that, and this is worth saying, I think CrossFit from day one has done an amazing job of getting people moving and creating community. Amazing. No one does it better than CrossFit. So kudos to them for that. I think that it gets people moving in a functional manner. I think it gets people to not be afraid of lifting weights. I think it gives them a safe environment to start lifting weights. Safe as in emotionally safe, not always safe as in physically and functionally safe. That is my only issue currently, is the level of coaching that I think should be happening and the level of coaching that I see happening. Again, this is just through social media, folks. What I see online. I'm not in a CrossFit gym. I'm not associated with CrossFit. So this is just my opinion, and like I said, take it with a grain of salt. I see a lot of injuries in CrossFit, and I think that you moving should improve your life, should help prevent injury. Obviously, yes, when you're lifting weights, you are increasing risk of injury in some way, shape, or form, right? You're putting a stress on your body, so there is risk of injury, but it's a lot in CrossFit, and I think that they can do better. I think that trainers in general can do better. I think that more education, a higher understanding of anatomy and physiology, definitely benefits trainers in any aspect, in any realm of fitness, whether it's at 24-hour fitness or CrossFit. So that's kind of my view. I think it's going in a better direction. I think coaches are getting more educated. I think that even on the business end, people are getting better. I think that there's more one-on-one attention, which I always think is safer than a large group class. So I think it's going in the right direction. Okay. I'm excited to see where it goes. And hey, you know that I watch the CrossFit Games every year, so can't judge too much. Next question. Which is most important, exercise or nutrition? If you had to choose one, hands down, nutrition. It is not my expertise, but that is, I'm not an idiot, you guys, and I'm not ignorant either. So nutrition definitely affects you. I think from a composition standpoint, for sure, definitely. I think from a cognitive standpoint, nutrition. How is your brain functioning? I think from a blood standpoint, so your triglycerides, your blood glucose levels, all of that stuff, nutrition. Like, exercise is great for you, obviously. Exercise is great for your brain too. Exercise is great for your muscles, your heart, your organs. But I think nutrition has a higher effect on all of that. You can exercise all you want. It's when you switch up your nutrition that you're really going to see and feel those results from your training. So hands down, in my opinion, nutrition. How to program cardio outside of lifting, if any, to improve body composition. So put simply, if you are doing cardio outside of lifting to improve body composition, then you are basically doing cardio just to add a higher caloric deficit to your training than you would if you were doing lifting alone. You could do the same thing via eating less food. So you could add cardio or eat less food. It's up to you. You can do either of those. You can choose whatever type of cardio you like to do. If it is just to improve your body composition, that's really up to you. And it is also has to, it depends on your training age, what type of cardio you have done in the past, what is your aerobic base like, can you handle high intensity intervals or not? So all of that has to be taken into consideration, but there is no one way to program cardio outside of lifting. Any cardio programmed outside of lifting is going to increase your caloric deficit, which hopefully will improve your body composition. So not going to overcomplicate that one. Next question. We have two more questions, folks. So this person has been lifting for 5 years. Is it necessary to still follow a structured program, or can you begin to lift more intuitively based on energy levels, your menstrual cycle, and things like that, your general wants? Yeah, 5+ years is a long time to be training. Obviously, that depends on what type of training you've been doing in those 5 years. But assuming this person has been lifting decently consistently for 5 years, followed a few programs, maybe had a trainer here or there, it really 100% depends on your goals. So I think that if you have a specific training goal of some kind, to increase weight somewhere, to increase mobility somewhere, to, you know, whatever, be able to lift a certain amount of weight or a given weight for a certain amount of reps, you need to be following a program because that's going to be the most effective and efficient way to do that. If you're just wanting to maintain and move to feel good, then I think that lifting intuitively is awesome. It's what I've done on this trip. You know, I go into the gym, I assess how my body is feeling that day, and I lift according to that because I have 10 plus years of program experience and lifting experience. So I can just kind of pull out of my hat and come up with a lift on the spot. So if you're able to do that, then absolutely. It's not your lifting years and your training age doesn't determine whether or not you should follow a structured program or lift intuitively. Your goal in training is what determines that. So if you have a specific goal, follow a structured program. If you don't, then obviously lifting intuitively is fine. So that is my 2 cents on that one. Last one, tips for increasing pull-up volume. So not just getting your first pull-up, but how to get from that 1 to 5. So put simply, and this might be oversimplifying it, do pull-ups often. Do a lot of pull-ups. In order to increase your pull-up strength and your, obviously your volume of what you're able to do, so your capacity. So in order to increase your capacity for pull-ups, you need to do more pull-ups. I would at least be doing pull-ups 2 times a week. I would be doing it on a controlled tempo, so make sure that you're not just doing pull-ups and not lowering down slower than you're going up. I suggest always going slower on the way down than the way up. You're more time in that eccentric phase. So eccentric is your lengthening phase, so your muscle is contracting and lengthening at the same time. For those of you that don't know, that's eccentric. Typically, it is the lowering phase of a movement. Time spent in the eccentric phase is going to increase the damage to the muscle and hopefully your strength in that muscle group faster than if you are focusing on only the concentric phase. The concentric is that shortening phase. So your muscles shortening at the same time as they are contracting. So that is my tip number one, is to make sure you're doing pull-ups at a volume that is at least 2 times per week, that you are going on a slower down than up tempo. I would also suggest doing variations. So this asks, you know, increasing from your first pull-up to, say, 5. There's also 4 different grips that you can do pull-ups with. So I don't know if this person is talking about an overhand pull-up, a wide pull-up, a neutral grip pull-up, a chin-up when your palms are facing you and you have a supinated grip. But I suggest using different variations of pull-ups, both to shock the muscles from different angles, to increase strength in different angles, and just to keep a healthier shoulder joint so that you're not always pulling in one plane of motion. Something to note with wanting to increase pull-ups, so a pull-up is a vertical pulling exercise, right? We're pulling up and down, opposed to like a TRX row or an inverted row or a single arm dumbbell row. That's a horizontal pulling action. So when you're pulling horizontal to your body. So a pull-up is a vertical pulling exercise. Make sure that if you are doing a lot of upper body vertical pulling, that you're also pulling in different directions and pushing in different directions. We want to make sure that that shoulder joint stays healthy. So make sure that you are doing, you know, single arm upright rows and things like that, pulling in the opposite direction. Just looking out for your shoulders there. That is all of the questions, fam. I hope that that was helpful slash fun, entertaining on some level. If this was helpful to you, if it was interesting to you, please subscribe to the podcast. If you have not, rate the podcast, give it 5 stars. That's 5 stars for those of you that don't know. And leave a review. Again, I say it every time, and I will probably say it until forever and always, the end of my days. You guys are the real microphone behind the FitsPro podcast. You are, your reviews, your subscriptions, your interaction with the podcast is what gets it in front of other humans. So I am forever appreciative when you guys rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, I am Annie Miller, and thank you for tuning in to the FitzPro Podcast.